Well, you thought I'd be waiting up when you came home last night. You'd been out with all the boys and you ended up half tied. But liquor and love, they just don't mix. Leave the ball or me behind. And don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. No, don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. Just stay out there on the town and see what you can find. Cause if you want that kind of love, well, you don't need none of mine. So don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. You never take me anywhere because you're always gone. And many a night I've laid awake and cried here all alone. Then you come in, a-kissing on me, it happens every time. No, don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. No, don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. Just stay out there on the town and see what you can find. Cause if you want that kind of love, well, you don't need none of mine. So don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. No, don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind.
Until the sun went down, and then you'd fill him a jug and he'd pass it around. Mighty, mighty pleasing, Pappy's corn squeezing.
Shh, white lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my Pappy kept on cooking.
Shh, white lightning.
Of Mountain Dew. I took a little sip and right away I knew, as my eyes bulged out and my face turned blue. Lightning started flashing, thunder started clashing.
White lightning.
Well, the G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on talking.
White lightning.
Well, I see this liquor came and he said, I'm tough. I think I want to taste that powerful stuff. He took one swig slug and he drank it right down, and I heard him a-moaning as he hit the ground. Mighty, mighty pleasing, your pappy's corn squeezing.
Whew, white lightning.
The G-men, T-men, revenueers too, searching for a place where he made his brew. They were looking, trying to book him, but my pappy kept on cooking.
White lightning.
The first thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride. on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind, but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my Mama seemed to know what lay in store. In spite of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried. Dear old daddy, rest his soul, left my mom a heavy load. She tried so very hard to fill his shoes, working hours without rest, wanted me to have the best. She tried to raise me right, but I refused. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
I sit alone most every night, watch those trains pull out of sight. Don't I wish they were carrying me back to Abilene, my Abilene.
Abilene, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there, you mean in Abilene, my Abilene.
Crowded city, there ain't nothing free. Nothing in this town for me. Wish to the Lord that I could be in Abilene, sweet Abilene.
Abilene, Abilene, prettiest town I've ever seen. Women there don't treat you mean in Abilene, my.
WRCT Pittsburgh. It's more fun when it doesn't make any sense.
WRCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norwood with your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Asthma affects 25 million people nationwide, and every day 10 people die with it, with African American women and children being most at risk. Early warning signs include coughing, especially at night, or with exercise and wheezing. Almost all asthma can be effectively managed with a good action plan. So talk with your doctor today. And for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
I'm Ella Harp, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
stars shining bright above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you'll miss me. When I'm alone and blue as can be, dream a little dream of me. Stars fading, but I linger on, dear. Still craving your kiss. I'm longing to linger till dawn, dear. Just saying this. Sweet dreams till sunbeams find you. Sweet dreams that leave your worries behind you. And in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream.
Kisses, they put me in a spell. Go right to the bucket in my wishing well. They pull all those strings connected to my heart. They put me together and they take me all apart. Oh, are those kisses that take me for a spin? They never keep me outside, they always let me in. I love it when they come on by and tuck me tight in bed. I'll say a little chant to conjure up a kiss or two and spark a new romance. As soon as I blink, I then knock and at my door. I love those bag of tricks and they keep me wanting more. All I want is those magic kisses. Magic kisses is all that I need. All I want is those magic kisses. Magic kisses is
Say who you are and what band.
I know. Hello, this is Reza from Le Vent du Nord. You're listening to WRCP Pittsburgh.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard joins us to share an on-the-ground perspective of what's happening on college campuses around the nation.
She's one of the leading litigators in defending protesters and winning numerous lawsuits.
We're also joined by Eleanor Stein, who was on campus at Columbia University during the 1968 protests.
Eleanor Stein is a terrific attorney in her own right, a friend of Michael Ratner's when they were both there in 68, and she's got a good memory.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. During the Occupy Wall Street protests of late 2011 and early 2012, the FBI treated the movement as a domestic terrorist threat. That was even though the Bureau acknowledged that organizers were calling for peaceful protests. Massive resources were deployed to track the movement, and FBI and counterterrorism agents around the country coordinated with local and federal law enforcement to track and gather intelligence, effectively serving as an arm for private business. Now, more than a decade later, college administrators are calling local armed police, summon riot gear, to arrest and in many instances brutalize hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters in actions and encampments that are sweeping the nation. More than 1,000 protesters have been arrested over the last 2 weeks on campuses in states including Texas, Utah, Virginia, North Carolina, New Mexico, Connecticut, Louisiana, California, and New Jersey. At UCLA last week, after pro-Israel supporters carrying symbols of radical Jewish groups, not of student age, allegedly threw fireworks into a solidarity encampment, students defending the camp were attacked with stones and sticks. Yet after an hour of violence, police standing nearby and watching failed to intervene. Joining us to discuss these ongoing developments is attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard from the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and its Center for Protest Law and Litigation in Washington, D.C. Mara is one of the country's top litigators defending protesters and winning several reforms in police practices at mass assemblies and demonstrations. Mara Verheiden Hilliard, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mara, as you know, back in the 1960s, city police were called in on many college campuses to intervene during protests. And that led to brutalization and, in some cases, even death of student protesters. Now, as a result of that, nearly every college campus has its own police force. Why, then, are local law enforcement agencies being called on to deal with the rash of campus protests?
Well, universities across the United States are demonstrating their true colors when it comes to academic freedom and free speech, all the things that they talk to their students about in their classes, but then in practice, they're crushing student demonstrations, peaceful protesters demanding divestment from genocide and apartheid. And they are unleashing their municipality police departments to use the force of the state, to use the force of the municipalities to bring in police who are armed, who have guns, who have stun grenades, who have handcuffs, so that they can take students out of these peaceful encampments and take them into custody and crush the protests, and we're seeing a massive wave of that right now.
Mara, in last week's UCLA case, police stood by for an hour as pro-Israeli factions threw stones, sticks, and fireworks into a peaceful encampment. What does this say to you?
Well, the UCLA police stood there while a fascist Zionist mob physically attacked the protesters, beating them with rods, with bats, in an extremely violent attack that went on for an hour or more, and they did nothing. And then they called in the LAPD to arrest the victims of these attacks and to violently take them into custody. And it says a lot about the university. In fact, even after the violent attack on their own students, the university came out basically condemning the students. That was their first reaction, was to condemn the victims of the attack. The level of political hostility towards pro-Palestine, anti-genocide, anti-apartheid students demanding that their universities divest is extraordinary. And the university presidents should be ashamed. It is really heartening, though, that a lot of faculty have stood with the students and themselves have been brutalized and arrested.
Now, Mara, some people have drawn the comparison of the nationwide surge of pro-Palestinian protests to the Occupy movement. And you were very involved in defending occupiers and uncovered evidence of both FBI and Department of Homeland Security monitoring of that movement. Do you think the same kind of federal monitoring of these protests is underway?
I think it is certainly underway. Given the fact that the political nature of the demands of the students, the divestment from apartheid and from genocide, the condemnation of Zionism, this is a deeply political issue that many in power in the United States oppose. And we have, over the years, seen the FBI regularly target those demanding self-determination for the Palestinian people. So we would certainly expect that that is occurring right now.
Attorney Mara Verheiden-Hilliard, what advice do you give to students who are deciding how active to be in school protests?
I think the same advice that we give everyone, which is to really look at who you want to be, who you want to be able to tell people you were. You want to be that person that's saying, oh, you know, these amazing things that changed our society for the better occurred, but I was never part of them. To follow your own conscience, to follow what you believe in, but to be also very mindful of what you are doing, what your risks are, to be able to make choices that are choices that you believe in and that you are comfortable with, to be as well informed as possible about what you're doing. But we absolutely support the right of people and encourage people and students to stand up for what they believe in. That is why we have our organization, the Center for Protest Law and Litigation, at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, because we recognize that all change in history has occurred because of the movement of the people, because of the willingness of people to stand up collectively for what they believe in. And we think that these students are so brave for what they are doing, for what they have been willing to do, because they believe so deeply in the cause of justice, of liberation, and against this vicious genocidal war that has killed tens of thousands of Palestinians.
And we want to ask you in a moment about the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. But Mara, you've alluded to the hypocrisy in universities touting support for free expression, but on the other hand, demonstrating to the world that they're actually limiting that. Can you comment briefly on the rise and contrast for us the increased crackdowns on free speech on campus, but at the same time, the erection of things like Cop City in Georgia training facilities that I think may be replicated elsewhere in the country to really increasingly militarize our police forces?
There is obviously has been a growing militarization of police agencies. I mean, police agencies have always acted as an occupying force against oppressed communities throughout the United States. And with every advancing year and every advancing technology, they grow in both strength and capacity and use of technologies, including military technologies that are deployed throughout American police forces to use against a civilian population. The training facility that so many people have stood up against in Atlanta is intended to train police in basically urban warfare. And that means that you are training police in how to basically conduct police combat operations against people living in urban environments throughout the United States. It is extremely dangerous that police are basically being trained and given a green light to look at the civilian population almost like enemy combatants in that way. And we and so many others, are deeply opposed to these kind of efforts. It is incredibly dangerous. And you see what the NYPD has been doing in New York. I mean, the NYPD is larger than half of the world's countries' militaries. And here they have been called in against students at university after university, after college after college. I mean, basically, they're marching their way through New York City, grabbing students, arresting them at the request of these students' own universities. And they've been brutal in these arrests. They're taking protesters, out of these encampments. And meanwhile, this is their great crime-fighting effort, is students who are standing up for what they believe in, who are engaged in protests and encampments. That's what we're seeing.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm here with my co-host, Attorney Heidi Bogosian. We're speaking with Attorney Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. Mara, you've been on site at several recent demonstrations. Given your decades of legal work defending protesters and holding police accountable, what are your observations of the new dynamics between police and demonstrators?
I think in many ways the dynamics don't change. Demonstrations take to the street historically in the United States. They are frequently and often historically met with repression by the police. But the fact that, as it says, the people will not be moved, the fact that even with extreme repression, when you look at the long arc, people always fight forwards towards liberation and continue the struggle. We've seen different tactics being deployed at different protests in different cities across the United States against demonstrators. And we've seen shifting tactics. We've seen efforts to, in New York, grab leaders and organizers and try and, in fact, arrest them, peaceful leaders and organizers targeting them out of demonstrations on the streets, again, by the NYPD. And in, other localities and other places, different actions by the police to try and suppress demonstrations at different points. These are the same things that we always see with every wave of social justice organizing and street protests in the United States. And historically, you can see that people have never stopped protesting and they never will.
What is the state of different viewpoint tolerance on U.S. college campuses? Are things getting more conservative?
I think what's happening right now is an interesting confluence where, what would be considered traditionally the purview of the, quote unquote, right wing to attack demonstrators who are basically anti-war demonstrators is also being embraced by many in the Democratic Party side of politics. And this is because of the strength of demands from Zionists who seek to demonize and crush student protests. The complete hypocrisy of this has become very paramount because, this has been supported by the New York Times and other newspapers with really false headlines, decrying the protests as anti-Semitic when there are so many Jewish students who are part of the protests, who are organizing the protests, who are with their sisters and brothers, who are Arab and Muslim and Palestinian and others from all backgrounds. These are so plainly not, the demand of anti-Zionism is so plainly not anti-Semitism. And yet, you know, you still see these constant messages being pushed. Congress last week has passed a resolution that would seek to shut down any anti-Zionist commentary on college campuses. And this was supported not just by the right wing, but by Democrats. This is a complete violation of fundamental First Amendment rights that you cannot criticize Israel and Israel's conduct. It says so much about where we are right now.
Are you seeing a chilling effect on people who want to protest but fear law enforcement violence?
Take a look at the streets. I would say that the students who are so brave have really shown the way. And yes, of course, this has to have some chilling effect on people who might otherwise think, can I do this? What am I risking? It always does have a chilling effect, but there's also going to be so many people who believe in their hearts that they cannot be silent with a U.S.-backed genocide. When you have U.S. weapons, billions of dollars funding this brutal, brutal campaign that is killing and murdering tens of thousands of people and children and dismembering them, and knowing that it is your government of the United States that is funding this, knowing that it is your universities who are invested in ways that support this activity, these young people are speaking up and speaking up proudly and with a conscience because they are not going to be silent in the face of this.
Mara, we haven't had you on Law and Disorder in a couple of years. Can you speak generally to any changes that you've observed at demonstrations and mass assemblies in general? Any change in police tactics? I mean, we know, for example, that laws around the country in some places are trying to criminalize protests, but are police still using less lethals and other violent munitions?
Yes, they are. In fact, we're litigating against the District of Columbia Metropolitan Police Department for its use of so-called less lethals against racial justice protesters. And in particular, we're among various issues focusing on their use of what are stinger grenades. These are explosive grenades that are thrown into crowds of protesters that break open with more than 100 pieces of shrapnel that go in all directions indiscriminately, that shred into people's legs. They are part and parcel of a stun grenade that can have and is intended to have sound and light to disorient people. So there you are protesting. You haven't done anything unlawful, and suddenly you are in the midst of these, like, grenade explosions. I mean, this is like warfare against people engaged in protest and First Amendment activity. And so we're fighting to try and stop the use of those weapons on behalf of people who've been injured by them. And all over the country, there are a lot of amazing civil rights lawyers and legal organizations who have brought and are bringing similar lawsuits to try and strip the police of using these military, paramilitary-type weapons against protesters.
Do you think police violence will escalate on campuses? And if so, what kind of lawsuits might we see against college administrators?
Well, over this past week, we've seen what feels like a coordinated crackdown of police violence on campus after campus, from coast to coast, north and south, with demonstrators being attacked by the police, with a lot of violence against student protesters, that again is supported by their own universities, this level of violence against them. And I would certainly imagine that in the aftermath of this, civil rights lawyers and legal organizations will be looking at Section 1983 claims for this violence against student protesters. But we're also seeing a lot of other attacks on students, including summary suspensions, where students are being immediately suspended from campus, being kicked out of their dorm rooms, being deprived of access to food, no place to stay, not being able to finish off their school years. And this is being done before there's even a hearing. And this is being done against demonstrators who are not accused of any violent conduct, simply of protesting on campus. This has happened at Columbia and at Barnard. It's happening now to George Washington University students who are subject to this. And it is completely violative of any concept of due process. It just turns due process on its head to take students and give them no process, no hearing before the punishment. It's like pre-hearing punishment. And it's clearly intended to intimidate and silence and punish these demonstrators who are standing up against genocide and who are demanding that their universities divest from genocide.
Mara, I may have read the news incorrectly. I thought I read that George Washington University asked the police to come and they refused, along with the mayor of D.C. Is that accurate?
The GW University wanted to clear their yard of peaceful protesters right away. And the command officials and the mayor's office in the District of Columbia decided not to do that. That decision would be in accord with laws that, you know, have been put in place as a result of lawsuits that we've brought over the years against the Metropolitan Police Department, laws that state that the policy of the District of Columbia is to support and allow peaceful protest on its, you know, streets, sidewalks, and parklands. The GW space is private property, but the encampment also flows into District of Columbia jurisdiction on H Street. So now we have the right-wing extremists in Congress, some of whom are completely funded by, in their initial campaigns, like Tom Cotton, by AIPAC, demanding that the mayor and the police appear in front of Congress so they can question them as to why they're not clearing this peaceful encampment, because it always bears reminding that the District of Columbia, in which we are in, is still a colony.
You mentioned one case that you're working on. Can you tell us more about the Center for Protest Law and Litigation and, in general, the kind of work you do there?
The Center for Protest Law and Litigation is a project of our organization, the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. And we have for more than, well, for about 30 years now, among a lot of our work is focused on defending movements for justice across the United States. And we launched the Center for Protest Law and Litigation to really focus that particular area of our work, which is a primary and dominant area of what we do, and to really name it and create a structure to identify and support that work. We have offices that are anchored in Washington, D.C., and also in the Bay Area, where our work in the Bay Area has been defending the student protesters, the Bay Bridge 78, and so many others who have been fighting against genocide and apartheid over these last months. And that programmatic work is really essential to the larger organizational work.
Mara, this has been a very enlightening interview. Thank you for being on Law and Disorder. Can you tell us about anything else you'd like to mention before we have to say goodbye?
I really urge people all over the country who are listening to this, if they are not themselves in the streets, in the encampments, to do everything they can to support these students. The students have taken great risk. They are being penalized by the universities. Some of them are going to be facing criminal charges. Others of them, even if they aren't facing criminal charges, are facing significant repercussions at the university, including these suspensions and upcoming disciplinary hearings, there is a strong need for attorneys who can provide support to this, and anyone who's interested in getting involved, they should feel free to reach out to us at the Center for Protest Law and Litigation. And you also can see what these campuses now look like. When Columbia called in the NYPD, which was chomping at the bit to grab these students in case, in some of these instances quite violently, and to arrest them, you know, they refused to allow, the NYPD refused to allow the press on campus while they conducted this arrest of the students. And then they themselves put out these appalling videos of them, like, raising the American flag, tearing down Palestinian flags. I mean, just really demonstrating the eagerness and political hostility that they have to the demonstrators. And then Columbia asked the NYPD, again, larger than the military of half of the countries in the world, to occupy the campus for the next 2 weeks. So now Columbia University is occupied by the NYPD in order to suppress any pro-Palestinian dissent. This is demonstrative of the university's views of their students. They're actually now they're shutting down commencements, they're shutting down speakers, they have canceled speakers across the country like USC. They're doing everything they can to stop people from being able to express themselves, including inviting in paramilitary police forces to become occupying forces on their campuses. That's the state of American universities and academic freedom and free speech. They can teach what they want in the classroom, but the reality is what we're seeing in the street.
Mara, we're so glad that the protesters around the country have you on their side. Thanks for your important work.
Thank you for having me.
Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, thank you so much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
I was dreaming, in my dreaming, well of an aspect bright and fair. And my sleeping, it was broken, but my dream, it lingered near. In the farm of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized, and my senses newly open, 'cause I awaken into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the world from fools. Upon the meek, the grace to shower. It's decreed the people rule. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. People have the power. Vengeful aspects became suspect and bending low as if to hear. And the armies ceased advancing because the people had their ear. And the shepherds and the soldiers, where they laid beneath the stars, exchanging visions, laying arms to waste in the dust, in the form of shining valleys, where the pure air recognized.
One of the great events of the 60s was the Columbia student takeover of several buildings on their campus, protesting the university's complicity in the war against the Vietnamese people, and their racist action in building a gym in a public park in Harlem adjacent to Columbia. The student actions at Columbia brought down a terrific repression. 700 students were arrested and beaten in May of 1968. Our own Michael Ratner, a co-founder of Law and Disorder and a law student at Columbia at the time, was also beaten by the police. For Michael, there was no turning back. He went on to become one of the great movement lawyers of his generation. We speak today with his friend and Columbia University student, anti-war Vietnam activist Eleanor Stein. Like Michael, she was at the law school. Eleanor Stein went on to become an attorney and a law professor in Albany, specializing in climate law. We will be speaking with her on the similarities between the repression at Columbia 56 years ago and the current repression. Eleanor Stein, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's so good to be here. Thank you.
Eleanor, what brought you into the anti-war movement at Columbia in 1968?
It's hard to conjure up those months and that year for people who didn't live through it, but 1968 was the high tide of the Vietnam War. In 1967, over 9,000 Americans had been killed, and of course, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese. And in 1968, that number would almost double to over 15,000. And in January of that year was the Tet Offensive, where the Vietnamese, who were fighting to get rid of the Americans and take over their own country and their own government, took over dozens of provincial capitals and many other towns and cities in Vietnam, including the American embassy for quite a while. And at home, it was May 4th, 1968, that Martin Luther King was assassinated. And cities all over the country, every inner city, exploded in rebellion in African-American communities. And tanks were rolling down the streets of Washington, D.C. So it's just a reminder of what the context was for us at that moment. And I was a first-year law student at Columbia. I was sitting in contracts class with my best friend, Gus Reichbach, who we'll be talking about. We heard people chanting outside, and Gussie said, "Hey, let's get out of here." We left, we ran outside, and the Students for Democratic Society and Students African American Society were staging a march over from the campus to the site of what was supposed to be an exclusive gymnasium for the youth of Columbia only, that was going to be located in Morningside Park, one of the probably the largest open green space in Harlem. So our protest against that was we had signs that said "Stop Jim Crow," but it was G-Y-M Crow. And people marched over to the gym site and were chanting, and then somebody climbed over the fence and sat down in front of the bulldozers, and we were off.
Now, Eleanor, Columbia students also took over several buildings on the campus those 56 years ago. They occupied the Lowe Memorial Library, where the president's office is located, and also Hamilton Hall, which they lately have occupied. What were the demands and the issues at the heart of this?
You know, the issues at the heart of it were the great moral issues of the day, just like today. One of the issues was stopping the construction of the gym, which was clearly seen as a racist enterprise. There was going to be a back door down at the bottom of the hill. Morningside Park, for those who don't know, is a steep hill. Harlem's at the bottom. Columbia, symbolically, is at the top. And it was going to be exclusive for Columbia use, but there was going to be a back door where members of the community could use, you know, occasionally. So one of the demands was stop the construction of the gym. The second demand was linked to the Vietnam War. There was an institution on campus called the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was a Department of Defense contractor that entered into agreements with universities and others to do research and do studies and scientific work for the war effort. And once we found out that the war was actually there in our campus, that our university was complicit in the Vietnam War, we focused on that target. And the specific demand was get the IDA, the Institute for Defense Analysis, off the campus and stop the construction of the gym. Those are the core demands. And then, of course, as the demonstrations escalated, we, as students are doing today, we added the demand for amnesty, that protesters not be penalized for their participation in the protests.
Yes. There was a massive crackdown at Columbia in 1968. How is this repression similar to what's happened lately at Columbia?
Well, it's amazing to watch this. It's so much like going back to one's youth.